Verse 17. On the first day of unleavened bread. Well, what's that? So we better have a look at that too before we go ahead. Unleavened bread is matzot. That's the Hebrew word for it. It is also a very ancient feast. It's something to do with the spring. It's to do with the beginning of the barley harvest. So this is not a nomadic feast. The nomads are moving. They don't have time to sow and reap. They've got their sheep and their goats and they're on the move. This is when the people, another culture step later, have settled in Jericho, seems to be in the oldest settlement, and then other parts of the hill country. They've settled now and they've now got tents or dwellings and they've now got crops that they can live off and they have to go back to. So unleavened bread is not a pastoral feast but an agricultural feast. But it's also a spring feast. So it's no surprise that prehistory, we've got no way of tracing this, the two feasts have come together. And so it happens that at the full moon they have the feast of Passover. And the full moon also initiates a 7-day, a week festival at the beginning of the barley harvest called the Feast of Matzot. So that's where we are here, on the first day of unleavened bread. Disciples came to Jesus saying, "Where do you want us to make the preparations for you to eat the Passover?" And Jesus said, "Go into the city to a certain man, unnamed and undescribed. Be that man, be that woman. Jesus wants to eat the Passover with you." That's Matthew's point. You be the person. So every man, every woman, any man, any woman. "Go into the city, say to him, 'The teacher says, my time is near. I will keep the Passover at your house with,'" here's the "with" word, "my disciples." And I'm sure, but from a literary point of view, I'm sure that Matthew wants his community to read that the way we're reading it tonight. He wants us to hear Jesus say, "I want to keep the Passover at your house with my disciples." So the disciples did as Jesus directed them, and they prepared the Passover meal. Just a small pause to do what I promised a little earlier I would do, to just go through the Gospel of Jesus. This is just chapter 26. And play with the text. And just notice all the occasions where the word "with" is used. I did this for fun and I thought you might enjoy it with me. I won't read the verses, they're all in chapter 26. "I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples." We've just read that. A few verses later we'll read, "When it was evening, he took his place with the 12. And again, "I will never again drink of this fruit of the vine until the day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom." And Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane. And now in the same chapter, texts about being, that's him being with us. Now what about us being with him? "He who has dipped his hand into the bowl with me will betray me." Peter, "Even though I must die with you, I will never deny you." Jesus, at the agony I am deeply grieved, even to death. Remain here, stay awake with me. Jesus is not into independence, isolated, rock-like. Jesus is about community, he's about love, he's about being with. Emmanuel means, chapter 1, God with us. Anyhow, back to this chapter. Could you not stay awake with me 1 hour? One of those with Jesus put his hand on his sword. And as a matter of interest, nearly all of those are in Matthew and in the parallel text in Mark and Luke. They're not there. The with word. So it's just something very dear to Matthew, something that he felt and lived and couldn't but express when he told his story. Matthew 26:20. When it was evening, Jesus took his place with the 12. And while they were eating, he said, "Truly I tell you, one of you will betray me." They became greatly distressed, and they began to say to him one after another, "Surely not I, Lord." And Jesus answered, "The one who has dipped his hand into the bowl with me will betray me." They're both sharing the same bread. Companions, that's what companion means, doesn't it? Panis is bread in Latin. A companion is someone who eats bread with you, breaks bread with you, shares a meal in your home. One who's dipped his hand into the bowl with me will betray me. The Son of Man goes as it is written of him. Matthew picking up all those lovely texts about the suffering servant and the mystery of one who shared our suffering with us and seeing them as fulfilled in Jesus. The Son of Man goes, yes, but woe to the one by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. That's a lament said with tears in Jesus' eyes for Judas. It would have been better for that one not to have been born. Please don't read more into that than's there. He's not saying Judas is going to hell. Who the heck knows who's in hell? Hopefully no one's there, but he may be. But that's not what it's saying. And when you see Jesus in the garden, call him friend. I find it a bit hard to believe that when Judas despaired and took his life, which is usually the act of someone who's immensely moved and can't cope, surely Jesus' embrace and word would be foremost in his mind. It doesn't mean the betrayal was good. Of course it wasn't good. But we don't have to play games and play God. We're all allowed to hope that for us, as for Judas, God's love would break through finally. At any rate, it is a terrible thing he is doing. And to betray Jesus or to betray anyone in this world who's innocent this way is an awful, awful, awful thing to do. Judas, who betrayed Jesus, said, "Surely not I." There's an interesting difference here. If you look up, when the other disciples are all distressed, they're saying, "Surely not I, Lord." That's the word of a disciple, Lord. Judas, don't want to make too much of it, but "surely not I, Rabbi," teacher. A formal, polite, disciple word. Sorry, student word, but not the disciple word. And Jesus replied, "You have said so." An enigmatic kind of reply, like agreeing, but agreeing with a different understanding to the person making the statement. He'll use the same thing to the high priest and to Pilate, comes into the passion narrative. It's like, well, that's what you're, they're your words for it. I don't judge you, but that's what you're saying. I'll leave it with you. By your words you'll be justified, and by your words condemned. After the break, I want to break before we look at the Last Supper itself. But just before the break, I want to prepare you for it a little more deeply. The Last Supper is a sacrifice. It's the Passover sacrifice. Now, sacrifice, how's your Latin? Sacrum facere, facere, to make sacrum sacred or holy. Sacrifice means taking something ordinary and placing it in the realm of the holy. To sacrifice means to unite with the Holy One, to pass over into the realm of the sacred, to consecrate. So it's a sacrifice, the sacrificial lamb, and the blood of the lamb is meant to represent my blood, your blood, our life, represented here and offered to God, to be united to God. Well, there's a beautiful text, a classical text in the book of Exodus, and it's got two parts, and it's about sacrifice, and it's really fundamental to the Last Supper. I want to read it for you and then take a break and then come back to the Last Supper. It's chapter 24, 1 to 11 of Exodus. And I'm going to read you the beginning and then the end and then the bit in the middle, because it makes two points about sacrifice generally, and they apply very beautifully to the Last Supper and, of course, therefore, to the Eucharist, which celebrates it. The Lord said to Moses, "Come up to the Lord." That's the point of all sacrifice. "Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, Aaron's sons, and 70 of the elders of Israel. You are to worship at a distance. Moses alone is to approach the Lord. The others must not come near, and the people may not come up with him." Ancient ritual, completely changed in the New Testament, of course, but ancient Jewish protecting of the sanctuary. Only Moses could come, just as only the high priest could enter the sacred sanctuary of sancturies, the Holy of Holies. So here Moses alone could approach God, and not the people, and not the elders, no one else. To highlight the fearsome sacredness of this encounter. Then there's the rest of the verses, which I'll come back to in a moment. And then the story ends stunningly, really, for an Old Testament story. Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel went up and saw the God of Israel. Under his feet was something like a pavement made of sapphire, clear as the sky itself, they say. But God didn't raise his hand against the elders of the Israelites. They saw God. They ate and they drank. Unbelievable. They actually broke the taboo. They went up. They shouldn't have gone up. They're not allowed to go up. But they went up. And God didn't strike them dead. They saw God. Not only that, they were caught up in communion with God, according to this ancient and beautiful poetic text, and they ate and drank with God. What we do every time we come to the Eucharist, and what's going to happen tonight in the Last Supper. Verses in the middle now, verses 3 to 8 of that same text. So that's the element of meal, of sharing a meal in a tent, in a nomad tent. A lovely image of sacrifice, a covenant sacrifice, communion meal. Here's the other aspect. When Moses went and told the people all the Lord's words and laws, they responded, "Everything the Lord has said, we will do." Moses then wrote down everything the Lord had said. He got up early the next morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain, and set up 12 stone pillars representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Hence, Last Supper, the 12 disciples. The new Israel, the renewed Israel, the universal Catholic, inverted commas, universal people of God. Then he sent young Israelite men, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as fellowship offerings to the Lord. The young blokes from the local football team can kill the ox. That's not the point of the sacrifice. Anybody can kill it. What they want is the blood. And the blood is the sacrifice, the life. The killing is just to get the blood. Moses took half the blood of these bulls that he's got and put it in bowls, the other half sprinkled on the altar. That's God, representing God. Half sprinkled on the altar. What's he going to do with the other half? Then he took the Book of the Covenant, Ten Commandments, etc., and read it to the people, and they responded, "We will do everything the Lord has said. We will obey." Moses then took the blood in the bowls and sprinkled it on the people. Same blood, uniting the people with God. This is the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. There's strange atavistic feelings behind it, really, in the original primitive thing, meaning if you break the covenant, your blood will answer for it. I mean, it's not all pretty. It's pretty ugly, primitive, tribal. Don't break this law, mate, or you're done, you know. Just what happened to the bull will happen to you. So it's also very unliberating. But it's taken on a much richer meaning here. There's a blood union between the people and God, and it's also there. And the 12 stones are there, and this blood makes a communion of sacrifice between the people and their God. I'll let you stop there, and we're going to come back to the last...